Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius in Pretoria. Herman, how are you doing?
Yes, in the exotic location of Pretoria.
Yes, and in a slightly less exotic location, we have Dr. John Endres, CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, joining us from New York, where he is currently on a trip. John, good to have you with us. I believe it's 6:45 in the morning there right now. Oh, I lost you for a second there, John. But yes, are you with us?
Yes, my internet went away and then it came back. Long may it last.
Long may it last. And you are joining us from Manhattan, where I believe it is 6:45 right now.
That's right, yes.
Very good to have you with us.
The sun is just coming up. Skyscrapers.
And I'm sure it's a bit chilly as well.
It is, yeah.
All right. Let's get into our stories of today. And the first thing we're going to talk about is our yearly polling, which comes out, I believe, on the 26th of November. Oh, is that correct, Herman? Which,
yes.
Herman will be doing a presentation on. But every year, us as the Institute of Race Relations, we interview South Africans. And in a scientifically valid poll, we go and we ask South Africans their views on a bunch of stuff, some of which include race relations. And every year we find broadly the same thing, which is that South Africans on racial issues are actually far less enraged, angry, seething with resentment, obsessed with these issues, and actually far more moderate and focused on, you know, improving their own lives. And it looks like the early results that Herman is going to, I think, talk a little bit about today, just confirm that that is still the case, despite the efforts of many, many race hustlers in South Africa. So the IRR polling finds that, for example, 92% of South Africans believe that the national team selection should be based purely on merit, not on any other factors. Support for this principle is 92% of Black South Africans, 92% of colored South Africans, 86% of Indian, and 93% of white respondents agree that excellence, not racial quotas, should decide who represents the country on the sports fields of the world. At the same time, once again, unemployment remains by far the most important issue identified by South Africans. 38% of South Africans identified jobs as their top priorities, followed by corruption at 10%, crime at 9%, and only 2% mentioned racism or BEE as their top issue in the country. And these patterns were consistent across all racial groups. Herman, why don't you take us through a little bit what we can expect in the polling report and what you make of these figures?
Yeah, so every year we commission this poll to make sure that we have a representative sample, and we ask questions about politics, about policy preferences, and about race relations. And earlier this year we published the first two, and now on the 26th we are publishing the last one. Now, I want to address a comment I see here, but yet they still vote for race laws. Now, this is a fundamental misunderstanding of what elections are. The problem with assuming that elections are a referenda, or a form of referendum on policy, is fundamentally to sort of overcomplicate and overestimate the ability of your voter, as a rule, to make a decision based on the sort of the intellectual grounds that you might prefer. And before we get on our high moral horse of looking down on some voters, the reality is that consumers, all of us, are equally guilty of this sort of irrational decision-making quite often. The shaving cream you might use, I doubt anyone did a scientific cost-benefit analysis to understand what chemical composition is the best value for money and what composition within the best value for money range is best applicable to your specific skin type, tone, and texture. It was probably just at the right height one day on a shelf 5 years ago in Dis-Chem that you bought it. And if we think that voting decisions are more complex than this, we are missing a very, very important part of human thinking. You can look at any sport league, and you will find at the bottom of the log, you will find supporters of that team. And if we appreciate the reality that tribal thinking permeates human history, it defines senses of being inside and outside, it defines sport loyalty, familial loyalty, geographical loyalty, and even political loyalty, at the end of the day, what you end up with is that elections, as valuable and as crucial as they are not actually a scientific reflection of public opinion. Let me give you a tangible example as to why that is. In March 1987, a report published an opinion poll taken from 1,820 white South Africans on whether people supported or opposed the Group Areas Act, one of the fundamental cornerstone laws of apartheid. 1987, March, 27% of white South Africans support the Group Areas Act. Now, to give you some context, in that same year as 1987, the Conservative Party, the KAPIA, overtook the PFP as the official opposition. So at the same time as having the Group Areas Act having only a quarter of public support, you do have a political manifestation that doesn't perfectly reflect that, because surely that was very much a PFP position that the Group Areas Act shouldn't be supported. But let's put it into context and understand that public opinion and politics are not the same thing, even though there is a very strong link. 1987 is 3 years before F.W. de Klerk releases Mandela and bans the ANC. It is 5 years before 70% of white South Africans vote in favor of the reformation project and the negotiations. It is 7 years before the first democratic elections in 1994, and it is 10 years before the coming into force of the new constitution. And yet, you've got a 10-year delay between public opinion and political reality catching up, because quite simply, the two are not one and the same. In 2019, R.W. Johnson and Mark Data did research that found that 54.7% of ANC voters wanted the party to be a pro-business party. So if we are going to assume that the race laws are why people vote for these parties, it is just not clearly reflecting the reality of how complex political decisions are. And then I see the reply, whether they vote for it on purpose or out of ignorance makes no difference. But that is just sort of a smugness that doesn't understand the context of where we are. It isn't ignorance or deliberation. Human beings have weird bases for political loyalties or cultural loyalties. And it's our job to understand them, not patronize them. And I can assure you that we are all guilty of these sorts of irrationalities. But what is important is to understand that with my 1987 example, public opinion is upstream from politics. That's why
it's the raw material on which politicians can build something different. That's one of the reasons we sort of highlight these things, is that there's this defense sometimes used by ANC supporters or ANC people that says something like, well, you know, we have to have B, we have to have these race laws, we have to have X, Y, and Z, because, you know, there's this great upswelling, the masses demand it. Well, no, the exactly. Masses don't demand it. It's an elite project
and
that hides behind popular support.
Our colleague Gabriel Krauser speaks of called general knowledge, which is not just understanding that you should drive on the left-hand side of the road and that other people will drive on the left-hand side of the road, but having the knowledge that they have the knowledge that we all should drive on the left-hand side of the road, meaning that societal friction actually decreases. So I see, do they not see what the party does? Sorry, but I won't let this slide. Well, obviously, the question you are basing on an ignorant assumption, in the sense that they aren't voting on policy. They are quite likely voting on other measures. And something that we also see in the data is that Black South Africans don't need white South Africans to tell them how badly they've been let down by the ANC. So instead, of assuming that the reason for our voting for this party or that party is the universal reason, it helps to understand why there are reasons for hope and why traditional forms of politics have so far failed to capitalize on that. Adriaan Vlok wrote a wonderful piece for the Daily Friend last weekend that I encourage everyone to read so that we understand. Public opinion is very valuable to disprove the masses want racism narrative, but it is also crucial to understand that if we want to change politics, we have to actually go upstream from politics. So the really beneficial stuff from the polling, from the scientific basis of polling rather than the sort of skewed self-selecting sample of a general election, that is where we should understand the nature of the country. And perhaps the last little factoid to put this out there, in 1994, 54% of the voting age population of South Africa voted for the ANC. In 2024, that was around 16%. It isn't that there haven't been changes. It's just that we should understand that in a very young democracy, as young as ours, there will be growing pains, weird patterns. And if you look at democracies across history, whether it's in the 1830s in the UK or in the 1850s to 60s in the US, this is how democracy in a very weird way operates. And the fundamental reason for hope is that the moderate majority of South Africans will be the bastion on which we can build a South Africa. And I think we are seeing it materialize around us.
John, your thoughts on all of this? I mean, there's there's a question of why do we do this? Why do we do this kind of polling? And I think Herman's just laid it out really well. But, you know, what do you have to add to this?
Well, I think I'll add the factor time to it, because the first observation is that this is not just an isolated finding in our polling. It is something that we have been seeing in previous rounds of polling for a while already. And that gives us a lot of confidence in that what we're seeing in these polls is true. It's also true that it's not just us making these findings. It's also other polling companies making similar findings. And that gives us even more confidence that it's true. The other factor of time that's important here is something that I've also seen in discussions about politics here in the US. And that is the notion of impatience. And we can see that people are getting really sort of fed up with lack of movement in the political scene. And I think that's also coming through in our comments here, which is that, in the United States, I think a vote for Mamdani, for example, in New York, is in many cases a vote of frustration, a vote against the status quo, a vote against things not changing fast enough. A couple of weeks ago, we saw Afrobarometer polling in South Africa saying that there was 49% support for military rule. Our analysis was that that was not because people were especially keen to give up their civil liberties, but again, it was an expression of this frustration that things weren't moving fast enough. I completely get that because I also get frustrated, but these things do move on long timescales. And one of the things that we've been pointing out a lot here in the United States is how long the IRR has been doing this kind of work. We've got our centenary coming up in 2029. This is almost 100 years of working for non-racialism, towards improving race relations, towards better policies. It takes time. It really is slow. And the frustration, I fear, may lead to political choices that promise faster results, but that also take or that allow for the undermining of civil liberties and freedoms. And that is a great risk in this development, that people will go for the populist, for the quick fix, for the authoritarian solution to problems that frustrate them and us, but give up a lot of freedoms in the process of doing so. And that, of course, holds risks for the future. So it's a really interesting topic that we're discussing here. It's not just in South Africa. It's happening in other countries as well. And a useful way to look at it is really on the long time scale. You know, think in terms of decades into the past, into the future. And that should help to get the analysis spot on, hopefully. Nick?
One last point I just want to make on this is it's also useful to show that South Africa is not like some other countries, which really do have a kind of division and violence within them that is really difficult to unwind. I'm thinking, of a place like maybe Lebanon or Northern Ireland during the Troubles, where genuinely half the population genuinely hates the other half of the population. And it's very difficult to find a compromise because everyone is just, you know, at each other's throats, and there's just, you know, lots of violence and that sort of thing. We have lots of violence, but unfortunately it mostly just seems to be directed kind of almost at ourselves. It's, you know, it's lots of people from broken families with nothing to do stabbing each other in bars, or people trying to steal something or stuff like that. It's not like sort of communal violence. It's not like, you know, pogroms against Jews in Tsarist Russia, or Hindu and Muslim violence in northern India or something like that. And that's a very important thing to know, because as Herman said, you know, that's a, this is why we originally called, I think, this series The Reasons for Hope. About South Africa does have this great potential to move beyond this stuff and to truly become a successful and thriving nation. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about South Africa's great project that our government seems to be very invested in emotionally, but is not really going anywhere particularly glorious, it seems, and that is the G20 summit. So with lots of sound and fury, President Donald Trump from the United States said that he would not be attending the G20, and more than that, no U.S. official would join the G20. Now, China's President Xi Jinping has said, you know, he's not going to be joining the G20 summit either, but he will send the senior premier, I think he's the second in command, Li Qiang, to represent Beijing at the meeting. Javier Milei from Argentina is not going to be attending, and also, of course, Vladimir Putin is not going to be attending, although that's for, you know, other reasons, the ICC warrant and all that. But I guess, John, my question to you is, it does feel a little bit like the G20 is deflating a bit, like a sort of a balloon kind of slowly going down. And the government seems very invested in this and what it means for the country's reputation. What's your take on this one?
Yeah, it's, I'm sure that the government is not very happy about these developments. I think it's been frustrated at the U.S. decision to not send President Trump, or President Trump's decision not to send himself, to put it more accurately, with the downgrading of participation by the United States incrementally over time, now being compounded by other world leaders announcing that they would not be joining. That is very much not what the South African government wants to see happening. The G20, I think, was seen as a massive stage on which to promenade and display the wonderful South African hosting abilities. And now that is being kind of undermined. I'm not sure to what extent this is driven by President Trump's downgrading, but I think it will have something to do with it. I suspect that Javier Milei's decision from Argentina not to come might well have been for similar reasons. I'm not sure about the Mexican president. We know the Russian president. The Chinese might quite possibly not want to have attended a summit where President Trump wasn't attending, and therefore downgraded his participation. And it turns into a kind of escalation of downgrades. And that is something that the South African government is not going to be very happy about. On the other hand, Nicholas, we are at least saved the embarrassment of more world leaders seeing the state of Johannesburg. So maybe it's not it's not all bad. Back to you, Nick.
Hey, you got to find the silver lining. I also noticed that in some of the reporting on this, the new prime minister of Japan has said that she's probably coming, but also she just needs to check with parliament and get approval from them. And, you know, that's not a yes, even if her excuse is true. So maybe she will come, but it does seem like this is kind of deflating a bit. We'll see. But Herman, you said to me before the show when we were discussing this, what a difference a couple of years makes for how South Africa is pulling this off.
Absolutely. One of my favorite comparisons in terms of where our country has global standing now versus a few decade or two ago is the birth of the Virgin Active gym franchise. The Health and Racket Club, as it then was a chain of leisure centers that was going to go under financially, costing 3,000 jobs. Richard Branson had never wanted to open a gym franchise in South Africa, but then Nelson Mandela picked up the phone, called Richard Branson and said, I think you want to come to South Africa and save 3,000 jobs for me. And he did. And that's why we have the Virgin Active gym franchise today, because the innate clout of a credible leader could get world billionaires, leading businessmen, to actually take him seriously. Contrast that with this, where we are now, where I doubt Truecaller might even recognize the Union Building's number if it rings somewhere in the Oval Office or Beijing. And you just have to appreciate how far the ANC has screwed itself from a position of immense moral high ground. I think in the last 50 years, only two figures sort of approach the level of international respect and benefit of the doubt: Yeltsin and Mandela. Both were sort of the liberation, conciliatory, amenable, kind figures of change. And then you contrast with how that capital was just wasted and spent. Even Mbeki, who was very critical of American foreign policy, particularly regarding the war on terror, even Mbeki would have had the clout, I think, to save this sort of embarrassment. Because let's be clear, you want to, as a hosting nation, you want to work the phone lines for months and years ahead of time to make sure that the route to your prestigious event that reflects on your standing in the world is well attended, well organized. These things aren't just done by sort of an RSVP or a WhatsApp poll. It is intense diplomacy. Well, if done properly, it is intense diplomacy, lobbying, ensuring, are you considering to come? Why not? How can we get your interest piqued in what we have to say? Months of actual proper lobbying precedes international events of this scale. Either South Africa couldn't muster that lobbying diplomatic capacity because on its own it didn't have the capital, or it didn't have the friends in countries with the capital to negotiate that sort of interests, or it didn't try. And neither of these options are quite encouraging if we consider what the ANC could once command on the global stage and what they now just simply cannot muster.
So I think that they probably did invest all that effort. I think they probably did invest that effort, but I suspect that Donald Trump threw a spanner in the works. I think he, being a man of rapid decisions, said, I'm not going there, and that was it. And given that he is the top leader, that decision stood. I think it cascaded through the other leaders. What I think is also useful to think about is that G20 itself as an event, has standing, has stature. Most world leaders would want to participate because they don't want to be left out and because it's so high profile. And so the fact that an event of such high stature is now collapsing, basically, well, exaggerated only slightly, but that its standing is not sufficient to attract world leaders after one of them has cancelled, I think is quite a problem. And I do wonder what the impact is going to be on the South African government. We invested a lot of money and hopes and expectations in this. How does it feel to be the international relations minister or the president of South Africa or the many staffers working on this over a long time to see this event now being downgraded in terms of its prestige? And I think it's not very pleasant. Maybe it has to be added to the long list of missteps and unfavorable developments that are currently taking place from the ANC's perspective. Well,
there'll be many residents of South Africa who would have gotten nice temporarily cleaned roads and painted road signs and stuff. So that'll be a benefit to us. At least that money won't go completely to waste. I reckon the European leaders will probably come, because it seems to me that every leader in the EU just absolutely loves to go to conferences all the time. It's very much in the EU's political culture. So,
Did you think the Meloni will, Nicholas?
Probably. I mean, she's not as culturally similar to us or to some of the other EU leaders, but I do think that pool is quite strong. The Europeans really love their whole multilateralism thing. The next most important leaders with China and America out are Germany and India, I think. So that's Merz and Modi. I think this thing is pretty much finished in terms of influence if either of them or both of them pulls out. I don't know, John, do you have any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's one thing that really struck me. I wasn't quite aware of the scale of the G20. From watching the news, I thought, you know, that's once a year, all the presidents and premiers meet, and, you know, that's about it. But that's, you know, there's so much more going on. There's like a religious meeting that accompanies it, and the think tanks have a meeting, and the labor unions have a meeting, and the foreign ministers have a meeting, and the finance ministers have a meeting. There's, yes, exactly. So it's a huge thing, and I suspect mostly very unproductive. So if you're an action-minded president like Trump, you might also say, like, you know, really, what's the point of this? It's 20 people sitting around and, you know, making sonorous declarations. Who cares? I've got better things to do with my time. I've got a country to run. So, you know, let's just leave it at that. If it was up to me, I would downgrade it quite a lot.
Nick, if I can come in here, we can almost call it the international dialogue. Because of the
challenge
for the ANC, number one, just seeming to only want to talk to itself and serious people withdrawing or not pitching. And that's really reflective of the ANC's deep malaise, is not only, I think, at a sort of an operational, political, geopolitical level, it isn't being taken seriously. I think South Africans have stopped listening to them. I think they have come to embody the type of promise, charge, delivery-free, talk shop-based, social compacting, sort of getting togetherness without actually improving material circumstances. And this is just another very embarrassing confirmation of that reputation of the ANC's all talk.
So imagine this, Amon and Nicholas, that the ANC, I think, has taken a long time to understand that it's not a 50% plus party in South Africa anymore. It's now a 40% party and is increasingly being treated like one. The national dialogue illustrates that. But we could also say, you know, where its convening power, its global convening power, used to be 70% under Mandela, and its reputation used to be 80% under Mandela. That's now also fallen below 50, you know, and so that entire convening power, the reputation, the electoral support is all dropping. And I think it is taking a bit of time for the ANC to catch on to what's happening. But this is an illustration. You know, the rest of the world is seeing it and is reacting accordingly.
And
yeah, what it makes me think about
incredibly
go ahead, Amon.
Damaging. Sorry, I'll be very quick. And that is incredibly damaging because we have to understand the ANC's one of its most fundamental assumptions is that it has the right, the ordained right to govern South Africa.
It's so a messianic organization, as our colleague Terrence often says.
Well, exactly. So this is not only an insult, it is a challenge to their fundamental beliefs about who they are and who the country is. And it really can't be more damaging.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that comes to mind as you guys are talking about this is I just think about how the ANC really has fumbled away a bunch of things South Africa had going for it in the 90s. One was this huge sort of diplomatic presence, this really good reputation, the kind of legendary figure of Mandela. But then it also had, you know, the sort of commodities boom, which helped drive our economy to some of those high growth rates. You know, we achieved quite a lot of successes in the 2000s, but they could have been even greater had not so many mistakes been made. And now that the wind is no longer at our back, we're really going to have to struggle to pull ourselves. And that's, you know, the lesson from all this for me is that this is exactly why you cannot squander your opportunities. When sort of the wind of history is at your back, you need to catch it and you need to fly with it.
And when the gold price is what, $5,000, and you used to be the top gold producer in the world, and somehow that has passed you by. These missed opportunities are not simply prestige and sentiment. I mean, we can point to actual economic fumbles.
No, exactly. Okay, let's move to Parliament, where, I don't know, this seems like it might actually be a bit of a good thing. It's also kind of funny. So, former Police Minister Sento Matunu's Chief of Staff, Cedric Nkabinde, has told a parliamentary inquiry, which is sort of going along in parallel to the Matlanga Commission, that he, quote, thumb-sucked information he had provided in an affidavit. Let's just say that no one has taken that claim well. He said that his affidavit was inaccurate because he didn't have access to his cell phone or laptop when they were confiscated in a raid last month. He also gave a bunch of incorrect dates for when Matunu was visiting Lusikisiki in the Eastern Cape, which was part of the questioning that the committee was doing. But nobody took this well. Soviet Lekaganye from the ANC said that this was basically a load of rubbish. He said, quote, go and look at yourself in the mirror. When you look at that mirror, see morality written in the mirror and read it and understand what it is. See integrity in the mirror. See ethics in the mirror. See all the values in section 195 of the South African Constitution and internalize them. Then make a statement. MK Party came down on him. Julius Malema said that it wasn't all his fault. He was just a useful idiot of other people who he was covering for, which is not exactly a defense. And the DA's Ian Cameron said, I respectfully don't see him taking it seriously enough that he should go back to the drawing board. The EFF's deputy secretary general has said that the EFF will be laying criminal charges against him, saying that, he's basically violating the standards that are expected from a parliamentary committee. Now, why are we bringing up this story? Well, Herman and I were talking about this beforehand, and in some ways this is sort of unremarkable. But on the other hand, when did something like this last happen? I can't think of it off the top of my head. Maybe I'm just forgetting an obvious case, but it does seem a little bit like a parliamentary committee is showing some teeth. Wouldn't that be nice? Herman, what do you take on this?
And this is a benefit of the GNU that I didn't foresee. In fact, I sort of foresaw the opposite of what's happening. So I was sort of almost perfectly wrong. And that is the reality that because of the suffocating majority of the GNU in the National Assembly or plenary floor session type of way, you can't really grandstand there anymore with any real consequence. Of course, it doesn't help that the theater burnt down and that it has become sort of less politically and historically impressive to chant things like pay back the money during the State of the Nation addresses and so on. But unpredictably, to my mind at least, political opportunism and grandstanding has moved to the committees. If we think about the budget, there was grandstanding there. If we think about the role played by parliamentarians in the Matlanga Commission and in the connected parliamentary inquiries there, what seems to be happening is that because the plenary floor is no longer a place for real theatrics, if you want theatrics, you need to bring it into the parliamentary committees. And that is wonderful, because then you get this weird situation where political grandstanding, opportunism, narcissism, and egotism actually accidentally trickle into the sphere of parliamentary oversight. And that is, given the givens, probably the best we can hope for.
John, are you going to rain on our parade, or do you agree?
I will not rain on your parade, but I would say that I do feel for the poor Mr. Nkabinde. I see some of the mistakes that he made in the statement seem to me the kinds of mistakes I would very easily make. Where he got his in the article it says he got his dates wrong for Mthunu's visit to Lusikisiki. He said it was in September, but it was actually in October, and that's something I could very easily say. And so I have some feelings of sympathy for Mr. Nkabinde, but I also think that Parliament, or rather the committee, is using this opportunity to make an example of him and point out that parliamentary testimony is not something that you can take lightly. We sort of can be approximately right or not do your homework or use words like thumbsuck, in terms of your statements. You've got to take it seriously.
Right. People should be scared of going before parliamentary
committee. Yes, exactly. Yes. And I think this is the process that's happening here, You know, all the parties are piling onto him. You know, the threat of criminal charges. Wow, that's pretty hectic. So if another witness is being called and says, you know, I don't feel like it, or I'm going to say what I think is right, but I'm not going to prepare properly, they're going to be looking at this and say, holy moly, I'd better take this parliament seriously. This is a very serious matter. And that is very useful. You know, that's something we like. This is parliamentary oversight with teeth, and that's great. Really should be welcomed.
It's also, I think, speaking to the political power of the Matlanga Commission, in that this conversation that it's unearthed now about everything means that all the parties have to look like they're on side here. Normally, the ANC committee chairs just protect officials and prevent anything, and then you have MK kind of spinning off on some random attack that's not very well founded, and usually only the EFF and the DA are fairly sort of pointed in their sort of criticism or their that kind of thing. Here, we've got kind of everyone on the same page, which like never happens in our politics, where you've got the ANC, MK, the EFF, and the DA all hammering at the same time on the same person. And that, to me, suggests that all the politicians are sensing that this is a big deal and you have to at least look like you're taking it seriously, which is also, I think, a good thing. And it shows that the system, in little bits and pieces here and there, is starting to sort of work, which is another reason to be perhaps optimistic about where we could go.
Yeah. In a way, Nicholas, sorry, that also brings us back to the beginning of the conversation. Sorry, you know, we're frustrated with the slow progress of political change. But, you know, the system is actually working. You know, you've got the ANC at 40% and dropping. And this has been, you know, it's been dropping since 2004. So it's not quick. You know, it's 20 years, 21 years that it's taken. But it does work over time. And maybe that's happening with Parliament as well. It's finding its teeth. It's finding its role. And it's playing the very useful role that it's meant to play in a parliamentary democracy.
Indeed. And that would be a very good thing. Last story, just going to go over this one quite briefly. On the show yesterday, me and McCorney were very praising of some of the stuff coming out of the medium-term budget policy statement, the midterm budget policy statement. And, you know, there's some good stuff there, some genuine kind of reining in of spending, and the fact that we seem to be stabilizing our debt. And I welcome from you, John, any alternative views if there are. But one of the things that did catch my eye was the story of Enoch Godongwana, the finance minister, sort of just deciding to have a kind of a whinge about the ratings agencies. He basically says that the ratings agencies are biased towards Africa and that, quote, they are behind the curve, given our nation's improved debt trajectory over the past 5 years. They might find one minor issue. For instance, our measurement of debt is not the same as theirs, and therefore they don't upgrade us. There is already a bias against the African continent by multinational institutions, by the investing community, by rating agencies. Countries with the same fiscal metrics get better ratings than Africans. There is little default for by African countries, by the way. They service their debt, even if people can't eat food, but they service their debt. John Herman and I were talking about this before the show, and we were like, okay, but like, you know, take the win. Like, don't whinge about the ratings agencies. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a super interesting question, because these ratings agencies do have a lot of power. They do also get it wrong sometimes, as the entire global financial crisis showed, where they were sort of very late to the party of recognizing that there was a problem. So that we have to keep that in mind. And it is important in the sense that the ratings that an agency gives a country's sovereign credibility, debt credibility, affects the interest rates and also the investment that a country can attract, as South Africa has discovered since it was downgraded. And so for a finance minister to whinge a bit and sort of, you know, try to drive the narrative towards faster and higher upgrades is financially sound, I think. But what is frustrating about it is that it taps into victim mentality, you know, where you say, poor us, we're being so hard done by, we wish people would treat us more nicely. And there, I think, you know, you're right, that's the financial markets don't care about your feelings. You know, they sort of want the facts. and persuade them with facts, which is what South Africa is doing. You know, we're getting our inflation rate down, yields are dropping, we're off the grey list. Like, this, you know, this is good. So I think, you know, persuade people on the basis of facts rather than your victim status.
I think that's a really good point, and that's exactly what he should have done. Is he should have said, if you wanted to argue with them, say, oh, you know, they always get things wrong, they're behind the curve, all that, and sort of point to examples of that happening. But the focus here was basically sort of an implication that, oh, maybe the ratings agencies are racist against Africa or the third world or something like that. And it's like, you know, that's just, as you say, it's just kind of weak victim mentality stuff. And you know, even though the finance minister should be lauded for some of the improvements we're seeing, you know, come on, dude, like, we're better than this. Herman, final thoughts from you, sir?
Yeah, no, I agree with John. And what I find sort of unfortunate is that this was a missed opportunity, because there might be merit in Gordon Gwane's criticism of the ratings agencies, but he could have delivered that in a way that boosted his credibility as a finance minister, that boosted South Africa's treasury reputation, rather than playing to type of the sort of preconceptions as to, the third world, always, you know, moaning victim. If he had quite simply done this in a sort of a think tanky way, where he said, look, I don't agree with the rating agencies for this reason. Look at, you know, that country versus this country, that country versus this country, the progress we're making here, there. If he had been Professor Gordon Gwane for a moment, not only would he have made the point that he wanted to make, that John says is sort of a valid point to make, of faster ratings improvements, but he also would have boosted his own credibility. And in the sentiment game of global markets and perceptions, it is very, very important to who is credible and who isn't, and who is based on belief and who is based on evidence and who is based on this trend or that trend. So Gordon Gwane could have made exactly the same point stronger and better without the risk of, you know, playing to the caricature of a moaning African head of finance.
Yeah, no, it's always something I roll my eyes at every time I read about, like, whatever it is, whether it's some sort of G20 meeting or the IMF or the WEF or whatever. There's always some NGOs and a couple of, like, really badly run third world countries who are like, no, you must just forgive all of our debt. And it just comes off as like, but why? You know, why should the rest of the world? And it's always like, well, you owe us because you're so mean to us or something like that. And, you know, it's not serious. And, it never works anyway. I think that's all the time for today that we have. But thank you everyone for watching. We hope you found this show interesting. Thank you, Herman. Thank you, John, for joining us from the US. Always good to have you, even though you are far away. And I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend. We'll see you all on Monday. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.